Now, we are in the midst of a church history class. For those who are new here, they show up 35 weeks into the class. So, you know, just want to let you know that we are in the midst of a church history class. And I decided tonight I'm going to bring the most boring lesson that I can. I've just felt the need to do that for a while. And so tonight we're going to talk about the rise of liberalism. Because where we're at this point in our examination of church history is we have now entered into an examination of the modern church. So we have come through, as we looked at last week, we've come through the era of the Civil War, and we've now made our way into the modern era of the church. There's no really good place to demarcate where the Reformation church and post-Reformation church ends and the modern age begins. There have been a number of historical markers that some people point to and say, that's the beginning of the modern age. But when you do it inside of church history, it's kind of hard to do that. You can do that in world history, but inside the church history, it's not so easy to do. So I've drawn sort of an artificial marker at the point, sort of midway through the 19th century, pretty much after the Civil War has ended, although maybe not necessarily, but during that particular time frame that you begin to move into the modern age. And so as the church now moves out of that post-Reformation world into the modern era, we're going to start looking at the various ways the church was affected by modernism itself and how it's reacted to that and so forth. So tonight we're going to be talking about something that contributes largely to the realities of the church after the Civil War. But much of what we're going to talk about tonight had actually begun prior to the Civil War in the early part of the 19th century, but now shows its full colors, if you will, after the Civil War. All right, and to do this, we have to start with a discussion of a significant event in the history of the West, and that would be the Industrial Revolution. The church is going to be deeply affected by this thing called the Industrial Revolution. And so in order to understand the rise of liberalism, we have to think about the Industrial Revolution. You might not connect those two things automatically, but they are connected, as I hope to demonstrate. Now, you remember that the Industrial Revolution is an economic movement that was created by virtue of the invention and implementation of new manufacturing processes. And that revolution really begins in Europe and moves to the United States. It is considered by some to be one of the most significant turning points in the history of humanity. Now, there have been some who suggest that it's probably the most significant advancement of human history since even before the second millennium BC with the Iron Age and Bronze Age, some have suggested, where almost every facet of human life is influenced by this event or by this movement. When you think about it, you think about how much of your life is affected by manufacturing processes in place today, technology, science, and so forth, all stemming out of this 19th century event. There's a number of things that I'll give you as examples as results of the Industrial Revolution. I'll just give you three. First, the standard of living for most of humanity rose dramatically as a result of the Industrial Revolution. Prior to the Industrial Revolution, the average household lived generally in poverty. But after the Industrial Revolution, especially in Western civilization, there was a dramatic increase in the standard of living for the average person. Now, most of that would be seen, of course, as you go from the 19th century into the 20th century, and the full fruits of that increase in the standard of living would appear in the 20th century, but the roots of it are found in the Industrial Revolution. Secondly, there's a massive increase in the population of the Earth after the Industrial Revolution. The world population rises dramatically. The advancement of wealth changes life expectancies in Western civilizations dramatically. The beginning of the 18th century, the average life expectancy was somewhere between 35 and 40 years of age. By the beginning of the 20th century, it had risen to 60. That's a massive increase in life expectancies. And infant mortality rates drop dramatically after the Industrial Revolution. the change in so many things that occurred in Western civilization improved the lives of people such that they were not only more comfortable financially, but they were also finding themselves living longer. And much of it also has to do, of course, with the Industrial Revolution affecting medicine and the medical world. And then finally, of course, one of the biggest and probably the biggest change that occurred in Western civilization was Western civilization moving from an agrarian-based economy to a capitalist one. You think about these. You think about the world in the age of the original American colonies, mostly agrarian, mostly people working on farms, raising crops, raising their families. What happens after the Industrial Revolution? A grand migration from the farms to industrial centers. Cities, urban areas become major population centers as a result of this, with the entire economy of Western civilization moving from agrarian base to capitalist, with large migrations, especially, as you know, major cities along shipping routes. Minneapolis, Minnesota is a city, is an urban area of two cities, actually, Minneapolis and St. Paul, of a population of about 3.5 million at this point, at today. And it's built at the mouth, at the Mississippi River. The reason it grows is because it becomes a major agricultural turning center for crops grown in the upper Midwest to go south along the Mississippi River. It grows up there for that particular reason. That's what is going on all over the United States. All of the major urban areas that you can think of today are situated in specific places where goods and services developed in the factories in those cities could easily move out from those places. That's a result of the Industrial Revolution. Thank you. This would have passed in a moment, but I appreciate the thought. Okay, so most historians date the Industrial Revolution from roughly 1760 to about 1820 to 1840. Notice the Industrial Revolution is actually prior to the Civil War, but as I said, the effects of this movement will continue beyond the Civil War into the 20th century. Okay, so the Industrial Revolution starts early, but it continues on. Most of the early technological innovations actually started in Europe, and more specifically in Britain. Britain was actually the high point of the Industrial Revolution in the first half of the 19th century. You think about how the British became an empire during that period of time, with their abilities to move goods and services from all over the world, including all the way from India. Right, the East India Company being a significant part of the military economic hegemony working in that direction. That's all out of the technological advances that are coming out of the Industrial Revolution in Europe. Well, naturally, those are going to come here, because what's going to happen is all that English stuff is going to find its way over here after the American Revolution, even, into the former colonies of England in that time. You remember, I'll just remind you that the primary emphasis of the original 13 colonies that we talked about a few weeks ago was economic. Remember, it wasn't religious. I mean, a lot of people like to think that the original colonies were established for religious reasons. There were many religious reasons for the colonies being established, but the primary emphasis of those colonies was economic. The United States was established on an economic basis to begin with. The development of technological advancements then massively increased this focus as time went by. It makes perfect sense, doesn't it, that the United States became the world-dominant economic force in the 20th century. Why? Because the Industrial Revolution moved from Europe to the United States, and the United States took advantage of that in a massive way to become the leading economic force in the world. Britain faded over time. The United States rose over time. So once the Civil War was resolved, let's put that in quotation marks, right, the focus of America could return to this economic shift, and the effects of the Industrial Revolution would now come to flourish. The economic realities that would flow out of the Industrial Revolution prior to the Civil War would ramp up dramatically after the Civil War, even as the South went through Reconstruction and even as the North went through its economic turmoils, you still have a massive uptick in this revolution occurring in the United States. Now, the primary technological advances of this era included the following. First, the advancement of steam power. Steam power had been in use long before the Industrial Revolution, but it was during this particular time that steam power was adapted to power engines which would drive machinery. And so steam power becomes a foundational element of that which would drive this Industrial Revolution. Second, the increase, the vast increase in iron production, the ability to produce iron on a massive scale through the use of steam power, became an important aspect to the development of the Industrial Revolution. Third, the invention of machine tools. Now, the ability to actually economically manufacture precision metal parts that would lead to the development of much more complex machinery. So it's sort of a cat chasing its tail issue. You need the parts to make the machines, but you need the machines to make the parts. And so in a sense, this was a time period in which you saw now a scaled up working of the development of machine parts. And then finally, and probably the most important for our discussion, is the invention of the factory system. The invention of localized factories, the move from agriculture to factories. And the first industry to really take advantage of this Industrial Revolution was, anybody know? No, that was in the 20th century. Textiles. The textile industry was the first to really take advantage of this. And in fact, even to today, the textile industry is still very much a product of the Industrial Revolution. Driving the movement. Now, all of that important to say because it drives the movement of human beings from rural farm life to urban factory life. Okay, and that's a significant part of what the Industrial Revolution did to the geographics of the population, of population centers in both Europe and in America. Now, there is a second Industrial Revolution that occurred later, beginning near the end of the 19th century. And it started when the process of smelting iron into steel was revolutionized by Sir Henry Bessemer, when he developed a technique for the mass production of steel. Now the increase of the wheels, if you will, of the Industrial Revolution are able to kick in dramatically with the advancement of steel production. Iron production increased dramatically, the smelting of iron before, but steel was still difficult to produce. But when Bessemer revolutionized the process, steel production is what then kicked it into high gear into then the 20th century. So now as you walk across the 19th into the 20th century, you now have the advancement of the Industrial Revolution in a second wave through now the development of petroleum products, right? So now you have oil turning into gasoline and other kinds of fuels. You have synthesized chemicals now being able to be produced. And of course, electricity, a significant element in the development and continuation of this process. So you kind of see it in two waves. You see the first wave as sort of an early industrial process developing the factory system, which is then followed by more unique and specific ways in which this process continued. And so if you put all that together in a timeline, what you find yourself then in the middle of the 20th century, or I should say in the beginning of the 20th century, is a massive uptick in the ability of human beings to produce new things. And so it continued. Now, there have even been some who have suggested there was a third revolution. Of course, we call that the technological revolution, which occurred in the 80s, in the 70s, 80s, and 90s, when you start seeing the advancement of electronics. So, but we won't go into that here. As I said, the effects of the Industrial Revolution was the mass movement of people into urban areas. And this created, of course, vastly different lifestyles and focuses. Okay, so imagine the working class people now crowded together around industrial sites. Cities that were small in size now burgeoned with people. Some cities increasing by as much as 10,000% in terms of their population. A small city of 10,000 like Manchester, England, became a city of 2.3 million. During the time of the Industrial Revolution. It's a massive increase in people coming to these places and huddling around these factories. The living conditions then became squalid in many places. very difficult. So you had crowded housing, poor sanitation. There were epidemic outbreaks of cholera and things like that that occurred in these various places because, you know, when you bring a bunch of human beings together, guess what you get? You get these kinds of issues, right? Now, of course, with the advancement of technology, the standards of living and political interventions, life improved. All right, these urban centers became livable places over time. The standard of living rose, food supplies increased, literacy grew, and there was a rise of a permanent middle class. I mean, by the time you get to the middle of the 20th century, there's now a permanent middle class in place. There's a working class, middle class, that now exists. And most of us today live in the world of the middle class. We belong to that central area of social society. So the church had to respond to this. Okay. Now, you remember I said that prior to the Civil War, the vast majority of American Christianity became what we called evangelical. The evangelical church broke out. But that doesn't mean that the other forms of Christianity disappeared. They did not. So the Protestant church as a whole, including the mainline side and the evangelical side, the mainline side being small, the evangelical side being larger, had to address this reality of people moving to the cities. And it changed, as I said, the lifestyle of people. Changed particularly the fact that many people who previously had considered the church to be at the center of their social lives now found the church to be outside of that center of their social lives. I mean, if you think about it, if you move to a city in order to go work in a factory and you're working 12 to 14 hour days in a factory 6 days a week, do you have time to spend sitting at your desk reading your Bible, studying and considering the Word of God? Do you even take the time to go to church and worship and these sorts of things? And the answer is no. The Industrial Revolution, particularly in these urban areas, was starting to have a significant negative effect upon the church and its participation rates in these urban areas. So the Protestant church attempted some things in order to reach these urban masses. It seemed reasonable that you would do so. Okay, and I'll give you three examples. Number one, there were some specific organizations established to go specifically into urban areas and attempt to reach those most reachable, quote unquote, with the gospel. And the two organizations coming out of England that were established to do this were the YMCA and the YWCA, the Young Men's Christian Association and Young Women's Christian Association. Those were both English groups, by the way. They didn't start in America. They started in England. But they were established or brought here, if you will, and brought to urban areas to try to reach young men and young women with the gospel. That was the original intention of the YMCA, contrary to the dance that now uses its name, right? But a second particular thing, which you might find surprising to address this urban apathy to the gospel, was the creation of Sunday school. The creation of Sunday school. Now think about it for a second. In response to the rapidly declining knowledge of Scripture and with the increased focus that people had with their time on the economic or financial realities of their lives, the amount of time given to the reading and study of Scripture fell dramatically. At the same time, so did literacy rates. Now they would eventually go up, but the initial inclination would be that kids with their parents going off to the factory to work, when would they go to school? Okay, so the first Sunday school was actually established in 1751. This is long before any of this, but remember, the Industrial Revolution in England occurred long before the one in America. And so in 1751, a guy by the name of Robert Raikes in Gloucestershire, England, established a Sunday school. And the original intention was that kids could come on Sunday, the one day they weren't in the factories working, could come to the Sunday school and they could learn math and they could learn reading and they could learn reading, writing, arithmetic, you know, all the things. And, of course, a Bible study with it along the way. Originally, the idea was to provide classes in all these various disciplines, since children and their parents were spending their weekdays in factories, and Sundays became a good day for a general education. Now, obviously, over time, as institutionalized education became the norm and children moved out of the factories to go to school, the need for the Sunday school to continue being a place where you learn reading, writing, arithmetic faded. But the idea of the Sunday school kept on. In other words, the church has kept the Sunday school for the teaching now, specifically, of biblical catechesis to the children. The Sunday school movement came to America in 1790, even before the 19th century, when Samuel Slater began one in his textile mill in Pawtucket, Rhode Island. By the early 20th century, the Sunday school movement was ubiquitous to the point where in many churches, the most important aspect of the church was its Sunday school time. In fact, in many churches, Sunday school was considered more important than the worship service. I'll never forget many years ago when we were living in Birmingham, and for a brief time, we dabbled with attending Hunter Street. And I'll never forget when Buddy Gray one day said from the pulpit, he said, "If someone comes to my church and can only give me an hour, I'm going to recommend that he go to Sunday school." At the time, I thought he was brilliant. Today, I wouldn't agree with that sentiment so much anymore. But that's how many people thought in the 20th century, particularly in the middle half of the 20th century, about the idea of Sunday school. It became so important in the Baptist church that in many ways the Baptist church was often identified by its Sunday school. And it was the way in which you did your outreach into the community, and many people saw it as the most important function of the church. It was a response to the Industrial Revolution. But there's a third way that this attempt was made to reach the urban masses, and it was in the adaptation of the old camp meetings. Okay, now you remember, I'll give you just a brief review. Remember a few weeks ago we talked about the fact that in the Second Great Awakening, First Great Awakening too, but in the Second Great Awakening, you had the beginning of the camp meeting world, right? In the Second Great Awakening in particular, you had the camp meeting that would rise up, and you would have the social life of many rural communities that was centered around the old-fashioned tent revivals that would occur. Well, Dwight L. Moody became one of those who decided that it was important to bring that back into the urban life. Moody lived from 1837 to 1899. He was a Chicago shoe salesman who was moved to act by the lack of religious life among the masses of the great city. Moody was converted by his Sunday school teacher, a man by the name of Edward Kimball, in April of 1855 when Moody was in Boston. He had moved there to work with his uncle, who insisted that if he worked, he also had to go to Sunday school, and so he went to Sunday school. He was converted by the Sunday school teacher who taught him about the love of God, and he was moved by the love of God by his Sunday school teacher. He moved the next year to Chicago with dreams of making a fortune and selling shoes, and so he went to Chicago and he took up the work of selling shoes. When the Civil War broke out, he conscientiously objected to joining the Union Army and instead joined up with the YMCA, where he spent time evangelizing many in the city. In fact, to the point where he created a very large Sunday school following of his own. He had a Sunday school class in his congregational church, and there were many who came because they had been invited by him in his street preaching and in his evangelization through the YMCA, and they came to his Sunday school class, and he developed a very large Sunday school class to the point where the class was too big to even meet in the church that it was in. And so he started his own church. He started an independent church in 1864, which was known as the Illinois Street Church. It is still around today. It's called the Moody Church in Chicago. In 1872, while he was visiting London, of all places, He was first invited to preach. This is the first time that anyone had invited him to actually stand in the pulpit and preach. In fact, he was even invited by none other than C.H. Spurgeon to go to the tabernacle and to preach there. And he was a powerful preacher. He had a style that was unique, and he used it to preach. In 1871, a year before he had gone to London, he had met a guy by the name of Ira Sankey, who was a gospel singer. And he and Moody toured together after 1872, after he had gone to London. He had toured in a number of places, even going to Ireland at one point to preach to both Catholics and Protestants, who were at each other's throats at this point, to preach the gospel in that place. Sankey would sing beforehand and lead a worship service, quote-unquote, with singing, and then Moody would preach, and they went around, and they did this sort of thing. He had a simple, emotive message of embracing the love of God in Christ, as he himself had experienced with his Sunday school teacher, and he used it to evangelize large crowds when he was going around. Now, you will notice that Moody sounds familiar, doesn't he? Okay, a singer that goes with him and goes around and fills stadiums full of people in urban areas and preaches the gospel. Does that sound familiar to you?
Sure.
Yeah, it should, because Moody was the beginning of an urban gospel revival movement that would continue into the 20th century with other men who would take up a similar methodology. And there are two specific men in the 20th century who did so. Both had the name Billy. The first one, Billy Sunday. The second one, Billy Graham. Correct. So the Industrial Revolution changed the way much of Western civilization was constructed, the way its culture developed, the way its people responded to the church, and how the church itself had to deal with the migration of so many out of farmland into urban centers. And so the result of all of that was the church needed to respond. We see it responded through organizations like the YWCA, through creation of Sunday school, and then finally through the itinerant preacher and evangelist that would actually go into these urban areas with the attempt to reach the masses in those places with the gospel. Out of all of that came something else, okay? I want you to keep that as backdrop, because now we have to sort of think about that's the economic and geographical realities, geopolitical realities of the days. But there's another layer on this that needs to be considered, and that layer is the theological, philosophical layer that goes across the top of that, okay? Remember, the church in every age isn't just people going to their churches and worshiping. There's also a level of theological discourse that's taking place around the church, right? Even in our day, there's a level of theological discourse going on around the church, right? We're aware of movements of discussions of social and racial justice taking place around us that are not directly a part of us, but they're out there, sort of an umbrella over the top of all of the church. And the same thing's going on here. You have massive political, economic, financial, technological, scientific advancements that are taking place during this period, but you also have a strong theological dialogue that's going on in this time frame. And there's always a connection between that lower level and the upper level. In other words, the theological discourse is always connected, in a sense, to what's going on in the culture underneath, right? Because you want to talk about how this and why this matters to us. Okay. So let's rewind for just a second and remember, going back to the 17th and 18th century, this was quite a few weeks back, we talked about a period of time in the history of the world called the Enlightenment. You remember that period of time in the 17th and 18th century that had spawned a period focused on the pursuit of knowledge by pure reason. Okay? Understanding God by pure reason. Okay? We don't need revelation. What we need is to understand God. We can think him out. We can deduce him out by virtue of reasoning. A continuation of the scientific revolution that had come out of the Renaissance. Remember that? And there were a number of specific voices in that period of time. You remember guys like Locke and Hume and Immanuel Kant, who all were a part of that reasoning process in those days, right? The idea that men could figure out God through reason without the need for special revelation. You remember we said that Protestant Christianity during that time became highly subjective, meaning what I understand about God is based on how I interpret the world and how I see God. Whatever the individual dreamed God could be, that's kind of how we understood it. That was Locke and Hume and Kant and others like him. Okay. That movement is 17th, 18th century. Fast forward now into the 19th century, that movement accelerates dramatically. And what drives it is the advancement of technology and science. The advancement of technology and science that had now created this whole new world order, economically speaking, religiously speaking, all that is going to affect how theologians, philosophers are thinking about the world, particularly theologians as they're thinking about the world. And they would fuel new philosophical studies. We'd call them historical and critical studies that would come out during this period of time into the nature of God and the nature of the Christian faith. Now, most of these movements began in Europe. Okay, they began in Europe, typically, and began with certain historical studies regarding the authenticity of the Bible and the stories that it told. One of the very first questions that was asked during this particular period of time is the Bible a reliable source of truth, information? Okay, think about living in the 19th century, in the midst of the Industrial Revolution. Science is advancing at an unparalleled precedent rate. Technology is advancing. The life expectancies are going up. People are much more wealthy than they used to be. Everything is now technological and urban-centered rather than agrarian. You can have all of that as a process. And so all of that begins to figure into how people start thinking about God. Happened during the Renaissance in the Age of Reason. Guess what? It's going to happen again here. It's inevitable. They included the propensity during this time now, to discard anything extraordinary or miraculous from the faith. That makes perfect sense. Since human beings, now think about how the average person is thinking, right? Since human beings are progressing in their abilities so rapidly, the assumption was that we would usher in a new age of joy and freedom and peace and abundance without the need of God. I mean, that's what technology is doing, right? Science is developing for us new ways of making machines. We're advancing the human cause. We're all getting wealthier. The middle class is growing. Populations are growing. Life expectancy is going up. So it seems reasonable that we should be able to just continue that until we have conquered all of the problems of humanity. And that's called futurism. That's the philosophy of futurism. That applied technology would advance the human race beyond poverty and class struggles into a utopian vision of equality and wealth and comfort, etc., etc., which advanced dramatically in the 20th century, didn't it? I mean, look around. You're living in probably the pinnacle of all of that in this time. And how do people think? I mean, I'm a Star Trek fan. I hate to admit that in public, but it's true. I'm a Star Trek fan. Gene Roddenberry's vision in Star Trek was of the idea that mankind would eventually use his technology to overcome every imaginable obstacle to human flourishing. And then he would be able to go out and explore the galaxy. And then discover that everything out there is exactly the same as it is on Earth. But nonetheless, he had a utopian idea. One of my favorite science fiction writers, H.G. Wells, writes often of the utopian vision that was prevalent in his day. Again, notice, science and technology, futurism, creating this utopian world that we'd be able to live in. Look, even Darwin's theory of evolution falls into this category. Darwin's theory of evolution comes out at exactly the point in time where this idea of progressing up from lower form to greater form flows right into his theory. Because what's the theory of evolution about? The theory of evolution is about the idea that progress of a species is about the survival of the fittest in that species. And as the fittest of each species survives, he adapts more and more to the world such that his species is advanced. So those species that fail to adapt, they die off. But the species that adapt and change and are molded through the evolutionary process, they continue on. And of course, Darwin took that all the way to human beings in arguing that we are simply a progressed version of those species that came before us because we just continue to climb up that ladder through the survival of the fittest to what we are. You'll notice how that fits directly into this idea of futurism. Man can progress beyond these parochial issues of poverty and class struggle and so forth. Look, who's one of the most significant voices that shows up, politically speaking, or economically speaking, I suppose, during this period of time? And the answer is Karl Marx, who argues that it is time for our society, for the lower classes, the middle class, to rise up and overthrow the oppression of the upper classes and to throw off religion because it holds us back. Remember, he called it the opiate of the masses because it holds us back. It's the drug that we use to kind of try to ignore our problems. Get rid of that, and we will be able to develop a society in which everybody will live in harmony without any poverty. We will all share everything equally. I mean, we'll all eventually get to John Lennon's perspective of imagine there's no poverty, right? That's the idea of Marx. And there are still people today who think that's possible, that we can somehow create that, utterly ignoring the human element in it and the fact that human beings are fundamentally greedy, okay? Ignoring that fact, but that's the futurism, the struggle, the idea that's flowing out. Okay, all of that then flows its way into the theological thinking patterns of theologians of the day. It makes perfect sense that at this particular time then you would see the rise of something which came to be known as Protestant liberalism. Protestant liberalism is simply an attempt to couch Christianity in the mold of these ideas. This futuristic idea of us progressing beyond where we are now to where we ultimately want to be. In fact, Protestant liberalism is built on the idea that history itself is a record of progress. You know, we started off in caves, according to some, right? We started off in caves, and then we eventually moved from there to a higher position, and then to a higher, and then here we are in the 19th and 20th centuries, and we're way advanced. Look how great we are and how advanced we are. Imagine trying to couch Christianity in those terms. History itself is a record of progress. Humans are not always as they are now. That intellectual and religious views have and must continue to evolve. Liberalism starts with the assumption that we are progressing, and it is important for us to progress. And even Christianity itself must evolve. And so, therefore, we will evolve it. The result, then, becomes a series of historical studies that cast doubt on much of the traditional views of the past, particularly of two things, Scripture and the early history of the church. Those two areas become the first areas of attack in liberalism. Now, I want to give you a few of the main voices of this movement called liberalism, Protestant liberalism. I'm not going to spend a lot of time in these guys because, and I'm skipping over some very important names like Kierkegaard, but I want to pick a couple of these guys and just at least show you a little bit of what they were thinking. Trust me, their thinking is so convoluted at times, it's really very hard to understand them, so I'm going to try to synthesize this down to something that makes sense. And by the way, that word synthesize will be a word important here. The first of these men that I want to talk about is Friedrich Schleiermacher. I love saying that name, Schleiermacher. He lived from 1768 to 1834. He is the father of modern liberal theology. So we got to start with Schleiermacher. Now, he's not the first liberal, but he's sort of the father of this movement. Schleiermacher was born in Prussia to a Reformed church chaplain, a Moravian, and educated in Moravian pietism. Schleiermacher rejected traditional Christianity early in life, and he even rejected rationalism, which you remember was flowing out of the Renaissance, and he embraced something called Romanticism. Romanticism was a short-lived movement, which is basically the idea that there was more to human beings than cold reason. That's why it's called Romanticism, because it's not just about reason, it's also about the emotional life of humans. Okay, so Schleiermacher stepped away from the idea of just cold reason to understand Christianity, or at least he thought it was cold reason, and embraced something called Romanticism. His main argument in the religious sphere, he spoke on a lot of other topics, but his main argument in the religious sphere was that religion is not a form of knowledge, nor a system of morality, as Kant had implied earlier, but a feeling. Okay? Now, when I say a feeling here, I don't mean an emotive feeling, you know, a short-lived sentimental feeling or a passing emotion that goes by, but rather a profound awareness of the existence of the one on whom all existence depends. In other words, Schleiermacher's position was, we can know intrinsically, he called it a feeling within ourselves, of our utter dependence upon something outside of ourselves. There's something greater than us, and we can feel that dependence upon that. He called it an absolute dependence on God, although I don't think his understanding of God would be what ours is in terms of Yahweh, the Creator, but a dependence upon something, okay, with significant consequences in rational exposition and ethical responsibility. He believed that religion, then, is different than knowledge. It's an understanding of historical realities only as subordinate to this sense of absolute dependence on God. Anything that cannot be shown to be related to the feeling of dependence has no place in theology. So let's not talk about it if it doesn't lead us to this feeling of absolute dependence upon something beyond ourselves. For an example, that the particular writer that I chose to use for this is the doctrine of creation. Schleiermacher would say that to deny creation would be to deny the dependence central to Christian religious feeling. I mean, we're dependent upon a God who's created, right? It's fundamental. But even so, no particular mode of creation is necessary. In other words, you don't have to agree that Genesis 1 to 3 is historical. I mean, you could have a completely different view of how the world was created, as long as you're willing to admit the creation aspect of it as an element of that feeling. The fundamental truth of whether Genesis 1 to 3 is historical or not is irrelevant. That doesn't matter. All that matters is that you believe there's a creator and that you're fundamentally dependent upon him. Schleiermacher, in fact, dismissed Genesis 1 to 3 as historical. He believed it was ahistorical. He believed it was mythology. But his idea was, you embrace that which you thought of, which gave you that sense of dependence, okay? In other words, I would put it like this. Since modern science eschews the idea of the supernatural, meaning everything could be explained naturally, the supernatural is unnecessary to this feeling of dependence. You don't have to have the supernatural. Thus, you can, according to Schleiermacher, you can reject the past or reinterpret it. It doesn't have to be what you think it is. It can be something else, which leads you to this sense of dependence, as long as the dependence remains. Now, try to explain that, and it's like, Schleiermacher's idea, however, took hold, and he became extremely influential in the history of the church. He, in the history of American liberalism, I should say, Western liberalism, better. His influence really doesn't come in the 19th century. It really finds its main locus in the 20th century. Finds its primary locus in a guy by the name of Karl Barth, which we'll talk about later when we get into the 20th century. But Schleiermacher had a deep impact upon the world of his day. He was a very popular preacher, and his influence over liberalism grew in later generations. Another guy close behind him is a guy by the name of George Wilhelm Friedrich Hegel. Just call him GWF Hegel is the easiest way to say that. He lived from 1770 to 1831, and he was the developer of something called a system of reason. System of reason. he argued there are three parts to reason. The first is to establish a thesis of something, okay, make an argument, then attempt to argue against it in an antithesis, and then eventually come to a synthesis of the arguments for and against a particular perspective. Okay? So this was what you call a dialectic. It had three parts. It's a dialectic in which you take something, you look at it, you declare something to be true, you attempt to argue against it in antithesis, then you find a synthesis between the two parts in order to figure out what's true and what's not true. Okay? So to Hegel, all that exists is the dialectic and the dynamic thought of the spirit, not the third person of the Trinity as we know it, but this spirit of rationality that was existing in the world, the whole of reality which is advancing and developing over time. And what Hegel argued is that Christianity simply sums up the entire process of human religious development. The synthesis of all of religious thought, thesis, antithesis, comes together in Christianity. He simply argues Christianity is simply the synthesis of it all. And he would point to the incarnation, the coming of the Christ, where the divine and the human fully unite as the apex of the relationship between God and humanity. It becomes the summation of the entire religious experiment. So everything up until that point was thesis and antithesis until eventually you have the synthesis of both God and man. In fact, you could make an argument that Hegelian position would be that God is the thesis, man is the antithesis, Christ is the synthesis of the three. Okay, so in other words, from Hegel's perspective, it's the Christianity is simply the summation of the entire religious experiment. Now, you will notice that Schleiermacher and Hegel are not anywhere close to the idea of Orthodox Christianity. Okay, I mean their thinking process is philosophical. It takes history, rewrites it to fit this whatever sort of narrative you want to use. And it's all a part of this new scientific rationalism and technological advancement, all right, that's kind of undergirding all of it, which leads us to a guy by the name of F.C. Bauer and his liberal school of biblical and theological studies at Tübingen. Tübingen's in Germany. Bauer and his follow, by the way, I was forced to take a course on Bauer at Bethel, whole semester of this most boring stuff imaginable. But the basic idea is that Bauer and his followers felt that the root of the New Testament was the dialectic between the thesis of Peter's Judaism on one hand and Paul's more universal appeal on the other. That the thesis was Peter and the antithesis was Paul, thus the synthesis was John's gospel. The fourth gospel synthesizes together Peter's Judaism with Paul's view of Jesus brought together with the fourth gospel and possibly even second century Christianity and the Gnostic influences of that come out of this in the second century. So from the liberal school in Tübingen becomes the beginnings of something called historical criticism, the study of church history through the lens of an evolving view of history itself. That the evolution of Christian dogma over time was an unfolding of what was already implicit in early Christianity. Meaning that what started in the first century between Peter and Paul was simply the first little bit of a massive movement over time to reinvent Christianity to what it needed to be through time, because history is evolving, right? Okay, notice how I keep coming back to the same terms of progress and evolution and so forth. These are the sorts of things that running through the minds of these people in these days. They're thinking, how has, you know, the Christianity of our day, is the same as Peter and Paul's? Well, no, it's obviously not. So obviously we need to think about how the history has gotten us to where we are today. And you think about that through the lens of progress, right? Scientific and so forth. So liberalism, American liberalism, then began to embrace the idea that Jesus was much more than what is presented in the scriptural accounts and had been blurred by the dogmas of the church over time. In other words, we don't really know what the original Jesus was because the advancement of dogma through time has hidden him under a mountain of things that people have believed and accepted over time through the period of the church. I mean, there's something to be said for that in a sense, because yes, by the time you get to the days of the Reformation, when Luther has his great revelation, you can clearly see that the Catholic Church has piled on a whole lot of dogmas on top of the original writings of the New Testament. So there's something to be said there. But the conclusion is not correct in that the idea is that the true beliefs of the church needed to be ferreted out through study and criticism. And I don't mean the true meaning of Christianity in terms of, okay, what does the Bible actually say? What does God actually reveal? No, the Bible itself is simply a part of this massive hiding of the true Jesus. And so critical, historical criticism was designed to ferret out who the true Jesus is. And this resulted in something in the 19th century called the quest for the historical Jesus. The true, finding true Christianity by finding the factual Jesus hidden behind the faith of the church. Who is Jesus? Who was he really? Everybody seems to know today, 19 centuries after his birth and death, of who he is. And we've built up all this mountain of thinking across the top of Jesus. But we need to dig through all of that using our massive intellects, and we need to figure out who this guy really is. Who was the Jesus of the Bible? Considering the fact that the Bible itself, of course, isn't even an accurate testimony to who he was, according to these folks. Give you an example of this that might hit a little closer to home that some of you may have heard of. In 1985, a group of renowned biblical and liberal scholars got together to form something called the Jesus Seminar. Remember that, Colin? The Jesus Seminar included guys like J.D. Crossan, Marcus Borg, Robert Funk, N.T. Wright. And what they did was they would come together, it's more than 200 of them that joined together, but they would come together and they would critique various papers brought forth attempting to examine various aspects of the nature of Jesus. And they would, the primary guys in this group would literally sit around a box and they would drop into a box a colored bead based on how much they thought that this particular thing that Jesus said or did was actually true or not. And so they would read part of John's gospel and they'd say, okay, Jesus said that he turned water into wine. Okay, how many of you think that's actually true? And if you actually think it's true, you drop in a red bead. And if you think it's utterly false, you drop in a black bead. Or if you think it's kind of true, you drop in a pink bead. If you think it's kind of false, probably mostly false, but maybe a bit of truth in it, you drop in a gray bead, etc. You know. Okay, in other words, we're going to vote on whether or not Jesus actually did these things or not. Notice the biblical picture of God inspiring a work, delivering it to us so that we could truly know him is utterly gone. And what's replaced it is simply men standing around arguing with each other with their own opinions about whether or not these things are true. That's the quest for the historical Jesus. It's the historical criticism of F.C. Bauer and his liberal theology, his liberal school, which was designed to make everybody take a scientific approach to Jesus rather than a revealed or biblical one. In other words, it's an 18th to the 19th century movement that attempted to understand Christianity within the framework of a new scientific and technological worldview, which leads to one of the most significant outcomes of this American liberalism, and that is something called the social gospel. The social gospel. Most liberals didn't buy into the social gospel, but there were a small core of liberals who devoted their efforts to exploring and showing the relationship between the demands of the gospel and the misery in which the urban masses lived. Okay, now I'm connecting this back now to these urban masses that were developed in the Industrial Revolution. What did liberalism attempt? What was another attempt by the church, quote unquote, to bring the message of Jesus, to bring Christianity to the masses? It was called the social gospel. It's generally traced to a man by the name of Walter Rauschenbusch, who ironically was a professor of church history at a Baptist seminary from 1897 to 1918. He insisted that the social and economic life of the nation should conform to the requirements of the gospel. not to the good effects of economic liberalism. In other words, don't just leave people's fate to supply and demand or capitalistic realities, but we should form a nation around the idea of meeting the needs of the most needy in our society, the poor specifically, okay? And what he was arguing then was that the task of Christians is to seek to aid the poor and promote greater justice, to overcome the evils of society before one addresses personal issues. In other words, the social gospel turns the entire emphasis upside down. In the gospel, the true gospel of Jesus, the real and fundamental need of the human race is sin and death, the solution to sin and death. But in the social gospel, that's turned upside down in the sense that it's not about your personal needs, it's about the needs of those outside who have economic needs, financial needs, and other kinds of needs that we, the Christian, can address. To bring in the kingdom of God through good works, if you will. And by the way, just as an aside, the YMCA, which I mentioned before, was an outgrowth of the social gospel movement. What was the YMCA trying to do? It was trying to advance the cause of Christ, per se, in the inner city by addressing the economic needs of the young men and young women who were involved or to whom they were appealing in these movements. This understanding of the message of Christianity became prevalent through much of the mainline versions of Protestantism. It did not take hold in evangelicalism, but it did take hold in the mainline churches. It took hold in the Presbyterian churches. It took hold in the Unitarian churches. It took hold in the Anglican churches. It took hold in the Lutheran churches. It took hold in the mainline churches. And by the early 20th century, by 1920, give or take, the social gospel was the gospel of those churches. The mainline churches became utterly liberal in embracing the social gospel. And it is still today actively taught and expected in many denominations. If I pluck a random pastor out of the PCUSA and ask him, what is the gospel? The general definition that I will get from him is going out and meeting the needs of the poor is what God expects us to do, and Christ came as the perfect example of one who gave himself for the needs of others. That's the message that you'll get. The social gospel is one of the primary characteristics of this liberal movement that occurred, particularly in the United States. And its message treats Jesus as a human helper, not as a redeemer. In fact, in many mainline Presbyterian churches like the PCUSA, the idea of Jesus as a redeemer is utterly foreign. It's gone. You don't even think of it that way. So this is the rise of American liberalism that occurs as a direct result of the Industrial Revolution. It occurs as a massive movement of human beings move into industrial life and culture, and the church responds to that, and it responds to that through, again, the lens of science and technology and reason and rationality that was prevalent in the day, and spawns this movement called the social gospel, in which the engagement of Christianity becomes now the poor rather than the sinner. And so this is the issue of, this is American liberalism. And you need to know that as you cross into the 20th century, because the way for us to understand what comes next is to understand this liberalism, because there will be a response to it in the 20th century. Now, it'll start in the late 19th century, but it'll find its pinnacle in the early 20th century, as known as fundamentalism.